Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Danielle Belou has a culinary empire stretching across the globe. But I got a chance to be with him in his New York restaurant kitchen.
I am putting one clove of raw garlic, who split and remove the germ as
now,
well.
Now, why are you taking the germ out?
Oh, because that one time, you know, I worked in France for a chef called... I didn't work with him directly, but I heard his comment, and the germ of garlic was giving a very vulgar taste to the dish.
Vulgarity aside, more of Danielle and his classic aioli, then baker Alice Medrick, and you. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We have a new Key 3 Star Chef for you. Now, the Key 3 is our ongoing project. We take you into the kitchens of the best cooks we know for a hands-on cooking lesson. We get each one to reveal the three key recipes they think everyone should know. Well, we headed to New York to meet with the many-starred French chef Danielle Belou. His restaurants span two continents, but we met at his first and most famous, Restaurant Danielle. He practically bounded out to say hello, giving us big kisses on both cheeks. Danielle is fit, he moves fast, and if kitchens didn't exist, you could see him doing the Tour de France. But his restaurant is brilliantly conceived. You come into a grand, dimly lit lounge and bar. It's all cool greens and blues. And then your table is announced. The double doors open to the dining room, and you're walking into Mediterranean sunlight, all glowing creams and apricot tones. You know you're never going to want to leave this place. But Danielle took us a step further, through the kitchen doors. Now you're in Zen land. Cool green glass tiles, stainless steel, immaculate stovetops, and set up in a corner is a blender, some vegetables, and a few eggs. Danielle, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm so excited to be cooking for you today.
Well, it's great being in this kitchen, I must
yes,
say.
Yes, and you're lucky because normally there's about 30 chefs working here at night. So we have the kitchen for ourselves. We are not open for lunch at Danielle. We're only open for dinner.
So we can just hang out here and cook together if we want.
Just for ourselves.
Okay. All right. We asked you to pick the key three recipes that you feel other cooks should know. So what are they?
Well, the key three dishes today, it's the braised beef. It's a chicken steak braised in red wine with root vegetable, an apple tart from Lyon, where I was an apprentice and I learned there. And we're doing an aioli with vegetable and seafood.
All right, so we essentially have a delicious French pot roast.
Voilà, right? pot roast, apple tart, and to start, we go to Provence and start with this beautiful array of vegetable and cod and shrimps in a garlic sauce.
And that's the
aioli.
Aioli. I've always had trouble with that word. So this is a dish from the south of France, right?
Yes.
What is the aioli?
The aioli is basically a very fluffy mayo with a garlic pungent flavor and olive oil inside.
So it's a
and a little bit
mayonnaise.
Of spice.
A homemade
it's a homemade mayonnaise.
Right.
But there's a trick to that.
So you're going to show us the trick?
Yes.
Okay. So we've got a blender set up here.
Yes. Yeah. I have a blender. And to do the aioli, you can do it by hand, but it's better to do it in a blender. And so I'm using eggs. And in the eggs, I am taking one egg, which I will poach in boiling water, a little bit of water. So I'm taking the eggs. I have about 1 quart of water with about a tablespoon of white vinegar.
And why the vinegar?
Oh, just to coagulate the egg white a little bit tighter around the
so that it doesn't spread. It just helps it come together.
Exactly.
So it's neat and tidy.
It's not as important how beautiful your egg white. The egg white is. You want the eggs to be together, but we're going to blend that eggs.
Why do you poach the egg? You're making a mayonnaise. Why do you poach the egg for the mayonnaise?
Because I think by cooking the egg white and by leaving the egg yolk half cooked, plus adding up another 2 egg yolks to it, I'm going to get a very silky, fluffy, light, and maybe a little bit more homogeneous mayonnaise. And it's maybe also the risk-free broken mayo.
Oh, so it won't break. It won't separate.
It won't break. It won't separate. And you can also add a little bit more water to it, which will even make it more fluffy.
That's a great trick.
Yeah.
Because homemade mayonnaise can often separate.
Yes.
And then you have a problem.
And so I am just...
Okay.
Pulling up with a strainer,
right,
and placing that in the blender. Then to the blender, I'm gonna add 2 more egg yolks.
Okay, so you're cracking the eggs. All right.
Yes, separating,
leaving the whites behind. So 2 more yolks go in.
So now we are going to sort of a basic mayo.
Right.
Process. But again, because it's an aioli, there is a little trick to that mayo.
And that is,
and I'm putting garlic. So here inside, after my poached eggs and my 2 egg yolks, I'm adding 3 cloves of garlic who has been split, in case you have a little vein with the
green germ
has been removed.
Yes.
And the clove of garlic was cooked in water until in 2 water. Basically, we poach it until tender.
Yes. Why 2 water? You mean you
because
poach it and then you poach it again?
I poach it first for 2 minutes, and then after I change the water and I poach it again until it's tender. So this way, it's a little bit less pungent, and it make it like sweet garlic. So I have the 3 cloves of garlic inside the blender, who is cooked almost tender, and I am putting 1 clove of raw garlic who split and remove the germ as
now,
well.
Now, why are you taking the germ out?
Oh, because that one time, you know, I worked in France for a chef called... I didn't work with him directly, but I heard his comment that the germ of garlic was giving a very vulgar taste to the dish. And that meant that the germ is bitter and the germ is...
And
so
we would never want to have a vulgar dish.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Now, what is going in now?
Now, I'm putting a tablespoon of mustard. So I'm putting about 2 large tablespoons of mustard.
Really nice tablespoons of mustard, Daniel.
Voilà.
Beautiful mustard. Okay.
And, of course, Dijon. It's a Dijon, spicy Dijon.
Right.
I'm putting also a little bit of espalette paper, who is that paper from... Be careful, it's spicy.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little bit... It's a hot paper from the Pays Basque. Espalette, the little
Basque
village.
Area between Spain and France. But you could use other chili peppers that you have.
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
And salt has just gone in.
So now I'm blending the eggs and garlic gently.
This is really a very easy thing to do. That's the
and
other
I'm
thing.
And I'm starting to add the olive oil. So the olive oil, you just pour it gently while things are blending.
That's about, what, a half a cup or so of olive oil?
Absolutely. We are using, it's, again, if you love olive oil, but I try to make it a little lighter, so this way olive oil can get a little heavy on this dish.
So you wouldn't do this completely with olive oil?
I mix with canola as well. So it's about, I would say, one-third olive oil, two-thirds canola.
Okay.
But you can... And as you are blending, it gets a little thicker. And I'm adding also a little bit of speed. So you can always add a little tablespoon of water to it as well.
And the water is what helps the...
Emulsion of the eggs and the oil.
The absorption of the oil.
Absolutely.
That's another trick to know.
It has more or less the texture of a fluffy mayo.
Oh, my. May I?
May we?
We're just sort of dipping our fingers off of the spoon. Oh, so, the garlic comes through, but it's gentle.
Yes.
And it is so silky.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's delicious.
So when you serve this in Provence, you have two ways of serving it. You can serve it with vegetable who has been poached in salted water.
Right.
And then you can also serve all the crudité you want.
All if the raw want, vegetables.
Exactly. And if you want your carrot to be raw, you can serve them raw. If you want them cooked, you like them cooked. And we always put also hard-boiled eggs. And here also today, I found some mussel. So I have some cooked mussel, I have the cooked shrimps, and the cooked cod.
This just looks gorgeous.
What I love for me, I mean, in that dish is then you take your fork and you dip it into the little bit of aioli. And every time you pick up a little bit of sauce, the aioli, and you just, it just give this wonderful sensation of very refreshing, very Provençal. Very al fresco, outdoor. Ah. I mean, you know, spring, summer. Here we are in Provence.
Danielle, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Chef Danielle Belou in the kitchen of his restaurant, Danielle, in New York City. Now, one more thing about Danielle. No detail or courtesy was too small or beneath him. When he insisted we all relax over a meal together, it was still morning and the restaurant tables were bare. Danielle ignored all the helping hands around him, and as we talked, he unfurled a cloth over the table, set our places perfectly, and he served us. Well, to listen to the rest of our conversation about his other key three recipes, braised beef with red wine and bacon, and a really clever caramelized apple tart, just go to the website. SplendidTable.org. You know, big cities are fine, but sometimes the back of beyond is the best place to eat. It's the fun of the find, the dynamite place you're convinced nobody knows about. Well, to save a lot of heartburn, let yourself be led to the back of beyond by the pair who knows it better than anyone. That's Jane and Michael Stern of RoadFood.com. Hey, Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Hey, Len.
Hi, Len.
So what's up? Where have you been?
We have been up at the international boundary, you know, the border between Maine and Canada. And we were at a very interesting restaurant called Rock's Family Diner, which is located ambiguously smack between two scenic markers. One says, this is the beginning of Route 1, 2209 miles from Key West. The other one says it's the end of Route 1, 2390 miles from Key West. So I don't know if it's the beginning or the end of Route 1, but it's the furthermost extent of it anyway.
It's the alpha and omega
of Route 1.
Of family diners and scenic routes.
So what kind of place is this? Is it a classic diner with the stools and the whole thing?
It doesn't – it's not – architecturally, it's not. Menu-wise, it pretty much is. It's kind of a meat and potatoes restaurant, hamburgers, hot dogs, chili dogs, but with a twist. Being on the international boundary, there is a real Acadian flavor to the cuisine, and you know that because there's a list of maybe four or five different mixes you can order. Now, in this part of the world, a mix is what they know over the border as poutine.
All right, you've got to explain this. A lot of people do not know what poutine is.
Okay, poutine is French fried potatoes, gravy, and cheese curds. It's kind of like what we might call cheese fries, or in New Jersey they call them crazy fries. But in northernmost Maine and over the border in Canada, it's a really popular dish. Apparently it was actually invented in Quebec.
And sometimes they use mozzarella cheese, and they usually drown it in brown gravy. And the French fries are those curly fries that they call JoJo fries up there. I mean, talk about stick to your ribs or stick to your hips
right.
or your behind or everything
exactly.
else.
And
you know, this is one of those dishes that can be just horrible. I mean, the potatoes just sodden with gravy and, you know, lousy mozzarella. But done right, if the gravy isn't too heavy and the potatoes are crisp and the cheese is maybe fresh mozzarella, as you can get at Rock's Family Diner, it's really a wonderful dish, especially on the side of a really good meat and potatoes meal.
It's also a great place for just square meal desserts. I mean, it's one of the few diners I know that actually serves Rice Krispie concoctions and big homemade cookies. And it's totally northern Maine. I mean, it's like no frills. And that's where they also – where they hold the annual Muskie Derby, the fish muskie, and the Ploy Festival, which are those strange Arcadian buckwheat pancakes.
So they do all of these.
They do all of these. Yes, indeed. And in fact, Rock's is the host of the Ploy Eating Contest every year at the Ploy Festival up in Fort Kent, Maine.
And you will never, ever be at a loss for knowing exactly how far you are from Key West.
Whether it's the beginning or end of your journey.
Well, thanks, guys. A little geography. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye. Stearns, Jane, and Michael are the creators of RoadFood.com. You can find their latest discoveries at SplendidTable.org. We're going to be back with magic tricks for summertime baking. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The last thing you eat at a party sets up the best memories. It's that old business of first and last impressions being the most powerful. So today we're talking last tastes, desserts, exceptional ones, and the easy tricks that the pros use to take them over the top. Now, this is Alice Medrick's specialty. She's a professional baker and chocolatier, but she thinks like a home cook. Alice has written Sinfully Easy Delicious Desserts, Quicker, Smarter Recipes. Alice, it's been a very long time. It's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
Alice, you've got a collection of these simple tricks that kind of take desserts into another realm. Can we talk about those?
I call them magic ingredients. And those are the things that will take something delicious into stellar, you know, something ordinary into good and something wonderful into more wonderful. And it's things that you can keep in the pantry, in the fridge all of the time, things you probably even have, like black peppercorns. You know, a little grind of black pepper over a chocolate mousse is to die for. Delicious. A little black pepper over figs that have been macerated in something, or just ripe figs, period. Or, you know, figs that have been caramelized in the sauté pan. A little black pepper. Flaky sea salt is another one. You know, today we want a little salt with our chocolate.
Right.
So
right.
How about a, you know, olive oil chocolate torte with a little flaky sea salt on top. And the beauty of putting it on top and using it as an accessory is you get the little crunch and the little burst of salt rather than having the whole thing taste salty.
What about orange blossom water?
Oh, I love this. You know, I love to drop a few drops of it over orange slices in a bowl of their juices, or flavor a little whipped cream with it, or grate a little zest over a souffle or a chocolate dessert. It just adds a little something. And again, putting it on top gives you that fragrance. It gives you a layered experience as opposed to flavoring the whole souffle or whole dessert with the orange.
And you can get that easily in a lot of shops, especially Middle Eastern shops. And then there is this the partner, rosewater.
Rosewater, same sort of thing. It's this fragrant floral thing that flavors whipped cream very beautifully. You can also put it in a fruit salad, and it just lifts it, even a glass of lemonade.
You know, there's something else you have here that I think people don't think about, that you can grate a cinnamon stick.
Oh, I love that. Either a cinnamon stick or a whole nutmeg with a little microplane zester. And again, it's a top note. It goes over or on top of something. So you get first the fragrance when you put it in your mouth, and then the taste, a little taste of the either cinnamon or nutmeg. And then you go into, let's say it's a chocolate brownie or some dessert like that.
Right.
It's a layering instead of a flavoring. And I just love it. And it's something that, you know, gets all over your hands when you do it, and it goes into the air. You do it just before serving, and it just makes a world of difference.
I think it'd be great to do it at the table over fruit.
Absolutely, I do it at the table. I do the same thing for citrus zests.
Allison, this magic ingredient list, you've got one thing. It's a surprise. Olive oil?
Extra virgin olive oil is a stunning dessert ingredient. I use it in a chocolate cake. I use it in a pound cake. And even easier, just a drizzle of extra virgin olive oil over a vanilla ice cream is just sublime. And you can put a little pinch of sea salt over there and you are done.
Mm.
Just magical.
Well, you know, not many authors that I've ever seen that have done dessert books have given over, I think, 3 pages, 4 pages to only whipped cream.
You know, I think whipped cream is one of the greatest dessert toppings because it takes nothing to make it, right? It's not like frosting or anything where there are several steps to making it. Whipped cream is easy, breezy. You don't even have to look at the recipe. And it's neutral, and it highlights dessert so beautifully and other flavors. But when you don't want it to be neutral, there's a zillion ways you can flavor it. You can infuse it with fresh mint leaves. You don't even have to cook it. In fact, it's better if you don't. Overnight with the mint leaves, you strain out the mint leaves and you whip your cream as usual, sweeten it to taste. Same with jasmine tea. I also sometimes fold whipped cream into
lemon
curd.
Just back up a minute. Jasmine tea. How do you do that?
You just put those, I use those jasmine pearl, any good jasmine tea. I put some in the cold cream and I put it in the refrigerator overnight. And I let it cold infuse, which brings out all these floral tastes. And then you strain out the tea and whip the cream as usual. It's great on a chocolate dessert or on a fruit dessert.
Is there a trick to getting chocolate, I don't mean cocoa, but melted chocolate whipped into cream?
Yes, there is. First, you melt the chocolate with a little water. Well, let me back up and say that any cook who has experimented by trying to add melted chocolate to whipped cream has probably ended up with either something that is so stiff after it's chilled, it doesn't feel like whipped cream anymore, or more likely when they pour that warm chocolate into the whipping cream, because the cream is wet and cold, it sets the chocolate too fast and you get a lot of flakes and shards of chocolate instead of a nice blend. So the thing to do is to melt the chocolate first with a little liquid. I usually use water, and that kind of relaxes the chocolate a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then when that mixture is cool, then you can mix it with your cream.
Right.
Then you chill it, and then you can whip it.
Brilliant. Alice, you are a magician, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Alice Medrick is the author of Sinfully Easy Delicious Desserts. Now, she left us with another idea. How about sour cream souffles? Delicious. Now, you're going to find her recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Tables refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things actually in their refrigerator. I have to come up with a dish with those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. But the final judgment comes from our celebrity guest stump master. And this week, it is Frank DeCaro, former movie critic of The Daily Show and now radio host and author of The Dead Celebrity Cookbook. Frank, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Frank, tell me, Dead Celebrity Cookbook?
When I was in college at Northwestern, someone gave a dead celebrity party, and we all had to go dressed as our favorite dead celebrity. And I went dressed as Yul Gibbons, who was selling grape nuts at the time, and then he said many parts of a pine tree are edible, and then he died. So I thought, this is perfect for me. And the one thing we didn't have, even though we had people dressed like Adam and Eve and people dressed like Judy Garland and Bilbo Jangles Robinson, we had everybody, we didn't have dead celebrity food. And I thought, well, that planted the seed of what we needed to do. And then I started collecting anything that had a celebrity recipe in it, and the celebrities took care of it themselves by dying. And so I just put it together.
So some of your great picks from the book.
Well, my favorite recipe in the book, and you promise not to laugh, is Liberace sticky buns. Okay, I think they're absolutely delicious. I made a batch of 24, and I ate 9 before they were cool enough to handle. So, and as I learned from Cookie Monster, they're a sometime food. You know, you're not supposed to eat as many as 9 at a time. And there's a whole chapter in there on recipes from Lucy, because it's Lucy's 100th birthday, and in 2011 it was, and then it was also the 60th anniversary of I Love Lucy.
I couldn't believe the amount of recipes the woman really liked to cook.
Well, I don't know if she liked to cook or not, but she left behind this treasure trove of recipes, and I thought, any woman who has been attacked by a 12-foot loaf of bread in her own kitchen on television, I think, deserves a whole chapter in the book. So that's how she... I mean, the woman smuggled a cheese home from Europe dressed as a baby. You have to give her some props.
Okay. All right. Now, we have a contestant. It is Katie from Washington, D.C. Katie, are you there?
I am.
Katie, say hello to Frank.
Hello, Frank.
Hi, Katie.
Okay, Katie. You have five things in your refrigerator, but I get some freebies. I get salt, pepper, water, okay, and three things that you really have in your kitchen.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Five things, Katie. What have you got?
Okay. So I have cabbage.
Okay.
I have sweet potatoes.
Okay.
I've got pomegranates.
Fabulous. Okay.
And membrillo.
Oh, that's the quince paste.
Correct.
Membrillo. Okay. That's four. What is number five? Is going to be a doozy. I just feel it coming.
There's a really nice cheese shop in our town, but they sell prosciutto ends. So I have a nice big hunk of prosciutto, and I think it's I think it's actually from Parma, but it may be like a pound of meat.
My people. Okay. Now, oh, wait, this is beautiful. I cannot tell you how pleased I am. All right. Why don't we bake those sweet potatoes and puree them and flavor them? Do you have garlic?
Yeah.
Do you have chili?
Yes, fresh chili and pepper flakes.
Okay.
And chili paste, Thai chili paste.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Okay, we're going to melt the quince paste with some of the Thai chili paste and garlic with you obviously salt and pepper. That's going to get stirred into the baked sweet potatoes.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that sounds delicious.
And now that is now utterly delicious on its own. Take those pomegranates, and you're going to squeeze that delicious sour sweet juice out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Put that aside. Now you're going to cut up those little bits of the prosciutto into little dice. You are going to take olive oil. This is my third ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
You're going to saute those little ends
in
the olive oil until they're golden and they've given off a little bit of fat. Take them out. In that, you're going to saute the cabbage.
Okay.
Add a little water so it wilts, but it still has a tad of crunch.
Right.
Now,
make a ring of that still slightly crunchy cabbage on a big platter.
Right.
In the center of that ring, you're going to make a beautiful heap of those gorgeous golden jewel-colored sweet potatoes.
Okay.
All right. Drizzle the juice of the pomegranate over the cabbage.
But not on the sweet potatoes.
Not on the sweet potatoes. And you're going to sprinkle all of that dice of that prosciutto over the sweet potatoes. And this gets served really as a main dish.
I'm salivating.
Oh, I'm so glad. So first of all, Katie, would you actually eat this?
Well, it's a big contrast between the sweet potato flavors and the cabbagey flavors. But I think it actually might work.
You think you might do it,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, I think I would.
Frank, what do you think? Do I pass or fail?
I'm coming to your house. Of course you pass. That sounds absolutely delicious.
Yes. Yes, and you know, there is just nothing like winning, I have to say. Seriously, thank you both.
Thank you.
You know, now that I think about it, don't you think that curry paste and the sweet potato with the quince, I think that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I'm actually just pulling it out right now.
I want the address off the air. I'll be there in about an hour.
You got it. And Katie, thanks for being a great sport.
Okay.
And Frank, you are just a gem for playing.
Thank you. This is like being asked to be on the Oscars of food shows. I'm thrilled and delighted. Thank you so much for having me here. Take care.
You too can play Stump the Cook. Call or email us with your five ingredients, and one of our producers may call you to play on the air.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall.
Time for your calls. Pick up that phone, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Ben is calling from Cary, New York. So, Ben, what's up? What's on your mind?
Well, recently I was following a recipe for a Slavic nut roll, and it called for shortening, and I didn't want to use the shortening. But I'd read about something called leaf lard, and I was wondering where I could get it.
Oh, well, you can make it. I mean, do you have any butchers left around? Because butchers are a disappearing breed. But do you have any butchers?
I went to four different butchers, asked for leaf lard, and they looked at me like I was crazy.
Okay, let me tell you what leaf lard is, because if you tell them what it is, then they're going to go, oh, yeah. Leaf lard is the fat that is around the kidneys of an animal.
Okay.
Of a pig. And it's considered the classiest lard of all. It melts into a perfect cream. It's quite delicious and sweet. And it's really wonderful. Now, you can go to a butcher and just ask for, when you get an animal, could you save all of that nice fat from, you know, around the kidney? And then you just melt it down yourself.
Just render it?
Yeah, render it. But, you know, you don't necessarily – you can cook with lard that you've rendered from almost any part of the pig. So if you get, let's say, some fresh bacon – in so many words, pork belly that's not been cured at all.
Okay.
And you just cook that very gently, okay, you'll get all of that fat is going to be just fabulous for baking.
Okay.
And you can store it, have a sterilized jar, you know, a jar that you have washed and let sit in boiling water for a bit. Put it in that jar, store it in the fridge, and it's going to last a long time.
Really?
Yeah. And boy, what you can do with lard and baking in terms of especially crusts and pastry, nothing equals it. It's flaky and delicious, and you can do it with any trimmings from the pig.
Okay.
You know, give it a shot. See what happens.
I will. Thank you so much.
You take care.
You as well.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, the weekly trivia challenge is ready for its big moment. Now, the question is, what's a favorite excursion from Taipei for food lovers? Well, we're going to be back with that answer and more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Now, we're going to be back for more of your calls in a moment, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or actually call us on a phone, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's a favorite excursion from Taipei for food lovers? Well, one of the most popular tourist excursions in Taipei is to the nearby capital of tofu, the town of Shenkeng. Andrea Nguyen tells us about this in her book, Asian Tofu. You go to Shenkeng to see tofu made the old way over wood charcoal fires and to sample street vendors' tofu done in more ways than you can possibly imagine. Then you move on to Kyoto in Japan for its famous multi-course tofu meals. And finally, you hit Tokyo, where a lot of upscale restaurants devote themselves only to tofu. Andrea calls it tofu tourism, and I put it up there with wine tours. Okay, back to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Linda's on the phone from the Villages in Florida. Linda.
Hello. It's such a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I've just moved to Florida recently and from the West Coast. Lived all my life in California and Oregon, and I have become part of a dining group, you know, a getting-to-know-you group of four couples that each one hosts a themed dinner, and somehow we got talking about Savannah, and I thought, I think I'd like to do a southern themed meal.
Oh, yeah.
But, of course, I'm not accustomed to cooking that way and was wondering about some recommendations of must-haves on my menu.
Well, I'm just thinking, first of all, you're in a part of the world where you could probably find Savannah-specific cookbooks, number one. Because there are differences, you know, you go from one part of the South to another, and there are real, you talk to Southerners, and, you know, it's just like going to Europe where you'll talk to somebody in one valley and they'll rave to you about a dish, and you'll find out it really doesn't exist in the next valley, or it's looked upon as being very foreign in the next valley. And that right. kind of tradition still exists in parts of the South. You know, Savannah is one of those incredibly gorgeous cities. Now, the first person that came to mind, the first cookbook that came to mind, is from a man who is from Charleston. But it's anything by John Martin Taylor.
John Martin Taylor, okay.
Right, because he writes a lot about the food of the South and of that area of the coastal area, the barrier, you know, the Great Barrier area where all those wonderful islands are. And it's the – and now, again, I'm moving you up a bit, but it's the area where you get the red rice, where it's the this wonderful – it's a long-grain rice called Carolina Gold, but you could use any good long-grain rice.
Okay.
And you cook a little bacon and a little onion, and you add tomato, and then you cook rice in that.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
Oh, it is so good. And then, of course, the great classic – from that part of the world, and I think this carries to Savannah, is shrimp and grits.
Oh.
And if you want to get great grits, do you have a little time before this dinner?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. There is a source, Anson Mills. Mail order from them because they do heritage grits.
Oh.
And their grits are fabulous. Most of the chefs in the United States, I think, end up using their cornmeal. And they do also a special Charleston blend, and they may have a Savannah blend.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, so I'd check out Anson Mills. Shrimp and grits would be one thing you'd really want to do. And then I think another thing you really, really want to do are great biscuits. And there is a recipe from Shirley Currier, I think it's on our website,
okay.
called Touch of Grace Biscuits. Shirley's from Atlanta. And those Touch of Grace biscuits will absolutely have your guests just, they'll be moaning. They'll be rolling on the floor. I mean, they'll be so happy. And then maybe what you might want to do is maybe some smothered chicken or something like a Frogmore stew, which is a stew of seafood. And it's really kind of a dry stew. It's kind of an intriguing stew. But I think if you start looking at John Martin Taylor and you look at Anson Mills and then check out some local cookbooks as well of what people are cooking in your area, some of the traditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much.
Have a great party.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Tim's calling from Washington, D.C. Tim, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I have always kind of had a love of the idea of making little filled chocolates,
uh-huh.
The bonbon kind.
Yeah, right, right.
And I've made a few, and they're okay, but they're not amazing like I want them to be. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions for places I could look for recipes for, like, nougat-y, caramel, that kind of filling, and maybe also techniques for how to make them.
Oh, dear. You know, I never liked filled chocolates. Now, wait, now let me explain. Until I made the call, I mean, it was a great chance. I moved to Belgium, and then I discovered, you know, the Belgian chocolates are famous, and boy, is that justified. I suddenly gained such respect for filled chocolates. And I know what you mean. I mean, you can do good filled chocolate, but then there's great filled chocolate. Well, you know, there's an old book. I mean, a really old book. It came out in the 70s or the 80s by Le Notre, L-E and then capital N-O-T-R-E. It was translated into English. He was one of the great, great caterers of France, and he had shops, and he did things like he catered for the president of France, you know. And Le Notre did a book on candy making. So that's one place to go. And I think it's out there.
Is it in English or
it's in English. It was written in French, but it was also translated by some really good people who knew what they were doing into English. So that's one. You know what? Go to Chocolat, Les Maisons au Chocolat. He's a French candy maker, makes brilliant, brilliant chocolates. But I'm just wondering if there is something there that you can either hook on to get to the professional blogs where candy makers are talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I would go. Now, I can't tell you exactly where to go.
Well, that's fine. It's a good start.
There used to actually be a magazine called Chocolatier, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Is it gone now?
I think it's gone now. I haven't seen it in a long time, but that's another trail to follow.
Yeah.
Because they were another one where they had a lot of professionals writing for just people like you and me, home cooks who really were ambitious and wanted to really make something very special.
Yes, definitely.
Hey, thanks for calling.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I can't wait to hear about what happens with the chocolates.
Yes.
My mouth is watering. Take care, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Robin in California has a question. She says, the hard cheese Parmesan and cheeses like that, they come with such a thick edge. It's really dry. I can't grate it, so I usually cut it away. But I'm wondering if I'm wasting cheese. Is there something I can do with that rind? Oh, Robin, this is the deal, especially with Parmigiano Reggiano. That rind is never wasted. It goes into things like soup. And believe me, it even goes into things like you put it in water with just some vegetables and you cook it. And you end up getting this fabulous flavor. And sometimes when people really were saving money, they would do that with the cheese. They'd take out the cheese. It's all rubbery. That rind turns really rubbery. Dry it, and they'd use it again. So you can make soup with it, or you can add it to soup or to stews to up the flavor. So if you're doing chicken in a pot, for instance, where you just put some chicken and vegetables and even water or broth, and you want to just add extra flavor because it doesn't just taste like cheese. It lifts all the other flavors. Put in a few hunks of that Parmesan rind. Okay?
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Georgia's on the line from St. Louis. Georgia, what can I do for you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I'm a member of a community sustainable agriculture, and I get a half share every week.
Right.
And I have sage in it, but I don't really know what to do with a lot of sage.
Well, you never want to use a lot of sage in any one place.
Yeah, it's pretty strong.
It is strong. But first of all, well, one of the great ways to use up a lot of it, though, is frying it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's two ways you can do it. One is you can dip it in a batter. So you would dip it in a little bit of egg, and you could roll it in something like panko breadcrumbs if you want to get really fancy. Or you could just roll it in what you would call, fresh breadcrumbs or dry breadcrumbs. Or you could just dip it in seasoned flour and shake off the excess. And then you can have a skillet, just a big shallow pan with maybe a quarter inch of oil in it. Now, the old-fashioned way to do it is in olive oil, and I think it's fabulous that way. Uh-huh. But you could use something like canola.
Canola, uh-huh.
And you get that oil hot enough that it looks a little wavy. You don't want it smoking. If it's smoking, you have to throw it away and start again. And you drop in those sage leaves. And you can turn them over with tongs or a fork. They're gonna crisp up very quickly. Uh-huh. The simpler way of doing it is to just make sure they're dry and drop them into very, very shallow oil. Give them a few seconds. You're going to see they don't shrivel, but they kind of collect themselves.
Yeah.
And they might curl a little.
Yeah.
And then you scoop them out with a slotted spoon and put them on paper towels, let them drain. Coarse salt on it, either way, whichever way you do it. Uh-huh. They are delicious. One of the things I like to do, especially with carrots, is I will take a little tiny film of olive oil in a pan, and I'll brown the carrots, and then I'll add a little bit of garlic to that or whatever with the carrots and a few sage leaves. Okay.
Oh, that's nice.
And then you cook those carrots either in their own juices or with a little water or a little orange juice or whatever. But when you serve them, fry up sage leaves and scatter them over the whole thing of carrots.
Oh, lovely.
And what happens is people eat the carrots,
but
the sage leaves are gone in 4 seconds. So that try fried sage leaves.
You're gonna, I will.
I think you'll really enjoy them. And then, I mean, sage is wonderful with poultry, with hardy fish like salmon. You know where else it's really delicious? In lemon desserts.
Really?
If you're doing,
how fun.
If you're doing something like a lemon curd,
One
of the things you might do is throw just one sage leaf into the mixture, cook it for a bit, and then fish out that sage leaf. You'll get a faint taste of sage. And sage and lemon is, and anything creamy. Mm-hmm. Or buttery is just delicious.
I make lemon bars. Would that be good in that as well?
I think so. It depends on the composition of them, but a little sage probably wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
But
great.
Again, be really careful. And by the way, they freeze like a dream.
Just the regular...
Just wash them, get them dry, stuff them in a Ziploc bag, press out all the air, mark it with a date, give it a name, and you've got it. And they'll hold for a year.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you're off.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy it.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. I have to tell you, my mother had such a heavy hand with sage. I thought I hated chicken when I was a kid. It wasn't that. It's that she packed it in sage leaves. Anyway, go easy with them. They're fabulous. You can reach us. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Though David Tanis is a cookbook author and chef, famous for his decades in the hallowed kitchen of Chez Panisse, he's like a lot of us. At home, every day, he cooks in a cramped kitchen with time not on his side. But David's flipped these two negatives into ingenious positives in his weekly column for the New York Times. It's called City Kitchen. David joins us from New York City. David, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. It's nice to talk with you.
So, David, you did a recent column on seaweed and seaweed salads. Tell me about working with seaweed.
Well, seaweed's been used in coastal areas for centuries, but here in the U.S., it's kind of been unknown except in the health food circles, and of course, among Asian Americans as well. The sort of seaweed that most people know about is the toasted nori, that is what is wrapped around sushi in the sushi bar. But the seaweed that you use for salad is available dried in packages in most places, actually, in Asian groceries, but also in supermarkets and specialty stores.
So what should we look for on the label?
There are actually hundreds of varieties of these edible marine algae. Most of them are from the sea. In Southeast Asia, they actually also use freshwater algae. But the most commonly available varieties here are three kinds. There's a reddish-purple variety called Dulce. There's a kind of bright green variety called Wakame. And those both make really wonderful salads. And then there's kombu, which is a darker, greener, a little bit thicker. Parts of it can be used for salad, but usually it's used for making broth.
So the idea here is that you rehydrate them, right?
You give them just a little bath in cold water, 10 minutes really, faster than soaking dried noodles like a rice noodle. You just give them a little bath and then drain them, and you make a little, very simple dressing. I mean, the one that I usually make is Japanese-inspired, so it has grated ginger and sesame oil, a little soy, and a pinch of sugar. Then you can add anything else that you like scallions or cucumbers.
Uh-huh.
You know, they just taste green and delicious. And so good for you. I mean, that's not the reason I eat it, because it's delicious, but it's actually just packed with nutrients and minerals.
So those seaweed salads that I see at sushi bars,
right?
Are they made from these dry seaweeds?
Well, they can be. A lot of Japanese restaurants buy fresh seaweed that's packed in salt and then shipped from Japan, like refrigerated. But essentially, you do the same thing with that. And other places will purchase dried. Most Japanese home cooks use dried seaweed.
Sounds great. David, thank you.
You're so welcome.
David Tanis writes the City Kitchen column for the New York Times. Find his seaweed salad recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this Nigerian proverb. Love is like seaweed. Even if you have pushed it away, you will not prevent it from coming back. SplendidTable.org is the epicenter of all things culinary. So head there to find anything you heard here today. And if you want to hear more episodes like this one, subscribe to our weekly podcast. You can find us on iTunes and, of course, at SplendidTable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.